All right, thanks for checking out the podcast this week. Before we get to my guest, a couple of things that I've been thinking about. I went to a couple of tag sales this weekend, and they're fantastic. There's always some great stuff, even if you don't need it. Like, I bought a chaise lounge cushion for $5, and I don't even own a chaise lounge. I mean, I couldn't resist it. I don't know, maybe I'll just put it on the floor. Yeah. Throw it in the tub. I think that would be a good place for it, and just lie in the tub. Nice soft cushion. I got a roller bag, a carry-on roller bag, four wheels, you know, that Victorinox, one of the wheels is broken. Bought it anyway, $5. I'm like, okay, three wheels, I can get around with three wheels. Maybe eventually I'll get a fourth wheel, maybe I won't, maybe I'll just carry it. But it was just such a bargain. I can't resist. I'm all about tag sales now. Glazed croissants. There's a market near my house that takes the croissant, which is about 80% butter, and puts it glaze all over it. I don't mean a little bit on the top. I mean, they literally drop it in a vat of glaze. I think they're trying to get to be the number one diabetic food source in the world. It is the most incredibly delicious thing. When you eat it, you have a heart attack. But I have health care, so what's the difference? By the way, why are we so shocked when animals do what they're supposed to do? This weekend, there was a shark attack very close to a beach of a seal. And literally, there were news crews out there and people are talking about it, and there's internet posts about it and blah blah blah. It's a shark. It's supposed to kill seals. That's what they do. Why are we shocked by that? Why is that even a story? Like, what's the hey, look, my dog, it took a poop. Wait a minute, let's film that. That could be something that no one would ever think could happen. The shark is supposed to kill the seal. You know what the story is? If the shark goes up to the seal and hands it a bottle of wine, that's a story. That's something you go, ooh, I didn't see that coming. Shark eating a seal, that's called a Tuesday. All right, so there are a couple of things that have been on my mind. My guest this week is host of First Take on ESPN, a co-host rather, Max Kellerman. Really great guy. I've been on ESPN with him a few times, and we have a really cool conversation about how he got into sports broadcasting, the state of sports, growing up in New York City. Just a really, really kind of wide-ranging and really fun interview with this guy, and a really nice guy. So enjoy it, and please leave comments over on iTunes for the podcast. The more we get, the better. And don't forget to send the links around to your friends. We want to keep spreading the word. All right, enjoy Max Kellerman. All right, that's it. I didn't know you could rap, man.
Oh, yeah.
I am here at the ESPN studios in Los Angeles with a very nice guy, a very brilliant guy when it comes to sports and other things. And I think I can call you my friend now. Max,
sure.
Max Kellerman. How are you, man?
Good.
Sports Nation and 710 Radio in LA. Thanks for doing the podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
New York guy here, Yankee fan. We were talking about iconic moments. I'm a Red Sox guy. I had that Shane Victorino double off the wall in that game six that ended up winning them the game. Iconic moments for you that you were at when you were
when I was a kid, it was harder to get up to the games. When they were good, I was a little kid.
Yeah.
They were winning World Series against the Dodgers and going to the playoffs up till 81. I was born in 73.
Right.
So then through most of the 80s, you know, it was the kind of thing where you're playing stickball. It's the middle of July.
Right.
You're on summer break.
Right.
You know, you're out in front of your friend's house playing stickball in Brooklyn somewhere, and then it's what do you want to do? I don't know. I'm bored. Da da da. let's go up to Yankee Stadium. So yeah. You just hop on the train.
Yeah.
Go up to Yankee Stadium. Get in the bleachers. Back then it was $5.
Yeah. Just and, go to the window and get a ticket.
Or yeah. Somebody. Yeah, no, you walk right up. Yes. And I remember thinking back then. I would look around, and it was the mid '80s. Don Mattingly, Ricky Henderson, and I'd look around and think, you know, it's 35,000 people here. whatever it is, but it's not sold out. And it's not, they're not, you know, they had a little renaissance in the late 70s.
Yeah.
But the days of the Yankees winning the World Series every year, those days in sports are over. So it'll never be like that again.
You think so? No one runs.
Well, I thought at the time when I was a kid.
Yeah.
You know, because this, the Big Red Machine would have a dynasty. The Oakland would have a little run. The Yankees, whoever it was, you'd have a little run, but it wasn't like for two decades, you know.
Right.
Between the 20s and the mid-60s, the Yankees were basically
in the... Right, like the Celtics winning 11.
Same thing, right. So... And I used to, like, dream of it. My dad grew up in the Bronx by Yankee Stadium. He used to tell me about DiMaggio and Mantle and Berra and all these guys. I thought, wouldn't it be great?
That must have been amazing to grow up in the Bronx in that era.
They used to take postcards, self-addressed postcards, and as the players walked in, they would drop it into the players' coat pockets. The players would sign them, give it to the guy in the locker room, and they would give all these autographs from the players. Yeah, so... I used to think, but you know, it turns out they never used to sell out every game back in the 50s, and it never happened like that. But I used to fantasize about it, and sure enough, you know, switch hitting center fielder like Mickey Mantle, batting cleanup, winning World Series, and there was this kid, Bernie Williams, in the minor leagues at the time, who was supposed to be a skinny leadoff hitter. And when I say that they surpassed every fantasy I had about because eventually the Yankees, starting in 94, really, when they had the best record in baseball or in the American League, even now when they've gone through some bad times, that just means missing the playoffs for 2 years, right?
Right.
So,
but probably just barely. You
know, just barely missing the play. They're in first place again. They won the World Series as recently as 09.
Right.
You know, to have like Bernie and all those guys come up.
Now, there was talk like Bernie was a guy that he was gonna be something big.
He was supposed to be a leadoff hitter that would steal a lot of bases, maybe. I mean, I remember that by like 87 or something like that.
I don't think of him as a skinny kid, but he must have.
He was a 17-year-old Puerto Rican kid with thick Coke bottle glasses.
Oh, Jesus!
That they signed out of Puerto Rico, and that was like as the Mets were dominating New York. That was the fantasy of all the Yankees fans. The fact that they. 96, they win the World Series. 97, they get back to the playoffs. 98, the World Series. 99, won the World Series. 2000, won the World Series.
And you're living in New York.
I'm living in New York. Yeah. I'm at a lot of these games. 2001, they come an out away from winning the World Series. 02, they lose to the eventual champs. 03, they're back in the World Series but lose. 04, they came a couple outs away from, let's face it, winning the World Series. Cardinals weren't going to beat them either.
Right.
So, like, you know, I couldn't believe that it was like all my sports prayers, the sports gods were listening and somehow answered because they had reestablished themselves.
Were you as fans, and you obviously a diehard fan, as well as people in the organization, because I'm sure you were reading the sports pages, whatever,
of course,
surprised at how dominant that team was? Like, okay, so you got a Bernie Williams coming up, and you got a
Jeter Posada, Pettit,
but
Rivera.
But they know that they were going to have that many.
First of all, in order to win that many, they won 4 out of 5 World Series with 3 tiers of playoffs. They came a couple outs away from winning 5 out of 6 World Series. That takes luck. I don't care how good you are, you have to also get lucky. I remember that. Like,
Of luck in any of those runs that you'd say, you know, it goes the other way, and then
There were so many. Like, there are too many to count. The Jeffrey Meyer game. That was game one of the ALCS, where he reaches over. I was at the stadium for that. Reaches over and catches the ball, and then Bernie hits the home run in extra innings.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. In 96, later on, the way they caught fire against Atlanta when they were down 0-2 and getting pummeled by an Atlanta team that was wiping everyone out.
Mm-hmm.
Even in 98, when they had the greatest team ever, they went in, they had to play Cleveland. El Duque, that's like where he really started making his bones as a postseason legend.
Yeah.
El Duque had the ball. He's maybe topping out at 92 miles an hour, and the lineup has like Kenny Lofton, Roberto Alomar, Albert Bell, Richie Sexson, Jim Thome. It's like one killer after another, and somehow El Duque gets through that lineup, and you know, but there are so many moments where you go, if this just breaks that way.
Yeah.
They don't win the whole thing. It's just one little break, one where. So in addition to being great, you got to get lucky, and they got somewhat lucky. I wasn't at the stadium for the Derek Jeter shovel pass, but I was during the regular season game when he dove into the stands against
bloody nose and everything
against the Red Sox.
You were like living there then. You were.
I got a little lucky too. Like I wasn't going to a ton. I wasn't like a season ticket holder.
But you happened to get. The right place, right time.
Right place, right
time. So did you know as a kid, I mean, obviously you're into sports from the conversation already, but that this was where you were going to, and that this was your path? I mean, as a broadcaster and a commentator and all of that?
No, I thought I'd be an actor.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And what wound up happening is, as college graduation approached.
Yeah, you went to Columbia.
I went to Columbia. I was doing a public access show on boxing called Max on Boxing in New York. And I was doing it just because I was a fight fan. And it was free to do the show. You didn't make any money. It didn't cost you.
It was out of the Columbia.
No, it was out of like a facility on 23rd.
Oh, it was
Street.
Like that public access channel that used to have Robin Bird on.
Robin Bird taped her show right after I was done doing my show. I did mine live.
For
used to see her all the time.
For people who don't know who Robin Bird is, she's this middle-aged woman that kind of did a borderline X-rated stripper show, and showed some stuff but not everything, and it was on, and I used to see her
all the time.
Really?
Yeah. Because I would be done doing my show live because I'd take phone calls. It was just me sitting there in front of a green screen taking phone calls on boxing. And then she would come in and do her show.
Was she cool?
She's an interesting person.
Yeah. So you're just in the boxing. You're 20-something. You're barely 20, 21, whatever.
I started when I was 16. I did the show until I was almost 25.
What was it about boxing that grabbed you?
I just love, you know, it's a fair fight, you know, every other sport is a metaphor for the imposition of one will over another, right? Mm-hmm. Even tennis, a one-on-one sport, if Agassi couldn't return Sampras's serve, that meant that Sampras had metaphorically imposed his will on Agassi, the ball being the surrogate for his will.
Right.
But if Lennox hit Tyson with a right hand and Tyson goes down, Lennox has literally, physically imposed his will on Mike Tyson by literally separating Tyson from his own will. As in, Mike Tyson's brain sends a message to his legs, get up, and his legs can't do it, right? So it's just more compelling.
Right. And so that grabbed you. Obviously a big baseball fan and sports fan in general. Yeah. But at that stage, you're thinking acting. You're in the acting program at Columbia?
No, I took some acting classes, but this is something that Mamet writes about since the dawn of time, right? People have tried to get out of carrying the firewood. And if you could tell stories, you could get out of carrying the firewood, right? And so everyone who wants to be, not everyone, almost everyone,
right,
who wants to be an actor, a director, who wants to talk about sports, who wants to be on TV or the radio, a musician,
right,
whoever it is, an artist, basically. Yeah. There are some legitimate artists whose brains are wired, right? Their whole brain is located on the right side.
Right.
Left-handed, like, artists.
Right.
They're wired that way. Right. My mother is that way, right? Like, she's just wired that way.
She a painter?
Yeah, painter. And then there are the rest of us who are like, oh, look at that. If you can fake it, you can get out of carrying the firewood.
You don't have to have a regular 9-to-5 job.
You know, it's not so bad.
Yeah.
So that's what the rest of us are doing.
So you figured out early on, use your brain and your mouth.
Yeah.
And like, just, that's so funny.
And but you know, you don't choose your profession. Your profession chooses you.
Yeah, that happened to me. I was a lawyer and a banker on Wall Street, and I left to be a comedian, and I didn't plan on it. I was working in New York on Wall Street, and then I gave some jokes to Jay Leno and said, you can use them for The Tonight Show, and he took them.
Well, what do you mean you gave some jokes to Jay Leno? You were just like, how'd you know Jay Leno?
He was at a private function that my firm was invited to, a client, big corporate client, and it was a private function, and it was like 150 people there, and we got invited. And I was just writing jokes as a hobby. I don't know why.
And you approached Jay. What gave you the nerve to approach? Let me interview you for a second. What gave you the nerve to approach Jay Leno at some function? You're a stiff. You're a lawyer. You're working on Wall Street. You walk. I mean, you're a double stiff. You're a lawyer and you work on Wall Street. And you walk up to a successful comedian. Yeah. And what gave you? You know, this is like a Seinfeld episode where Costanza gets laughed out of the building.
I don't know. Ask me how I got Paul McCartney on my podcast.
Okay, wait. First, go back to Jay Leno. What? So you walked up to him?
I just walked up to him after a show, and I was like, I don't know. If you don't ask, what the
So
hell,
what did you tell him?
I said, look, I'm a lawyer on Wall Street. I like comedy. I've always been a fan of yours. I write jokes as a hobby. I think I've really said it. Like, I think I go, I have a bunch, and I had like 10 pages.
And he's looking at you going, oh, this guy. This is the 11th time that's happened to him that week.
I know.
Oh, this guy.
I know. And I'm like, and my hand was shaking a little bit. And I go, if you need jokes, you can have them. I said, you literally can have them.
That's offensive to Jay Leno to hear that. But so he took them?
He took them. He was very nice. He was like, yeah. And I thought he was going to throw them out, right? Because I thought it was like, And he called me 2 days later. He was staying in
the
New York.
Just shows you how desperate comedians must be for material. Right? Like, he actually looked. He's like, listen, what could it hurt? Let me take a look.
This poor schmuck. He's yeah. having the thing. And he calls me and says, look, I need a lot of jokes for the Tonight Show monologue. I can't do jokes for my act. I got my staff of writers, but I also have a small group of, like, he was calling, like, email writers, whatever. You send in a joke. If I use it, I pay you $50. I'm like, is this a
50
gag?
Bucks a joke? Who are you, Peter Parker? He's James Jonah Jameson giving you $50 for a shot of Spider-Man?
Yeah, exactly.
$50 for a joke on the Tonight Show?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
But listen, you do what you got to do.
Next week, calls me. Hey, it's Jay Leno. He goes, I'm going to do one of your jokes on the Tonight Show tonight. This is all within 10 days of going up to him, right, that thing. And I literally said to him, why are you calling me? Don't you have like an assistant? He goes, nah, I like to keep it touch.
It's out of guilt because he's only giving you $50.
He figures. Oh, by the way, he said to me, what do you do for a living? I go, I'm a lawyer. He goes, I knew it. I go, why? He goes, you're right like a lawyer. You're too wordy. He goes, trim down the setups and get to the punchline. He did that joke that night. And this profession chose me. I was just like...
So wait a minute. So he does the joke.
He does the joke.
What was the joke?
The joke was about this old house and how it doesn't really represent reality because the contractors are always really nice, under budget, and polite. And in
right.
real life, they're like...
You anticipated all like Adam Carolla's show to catch a contractor.
Exactly.
And right.
They're hitting on your wife and drunk. And it did really well. Got a nice big laugh. And I was like, oh my God.
And did he send you $50?
He sent me $50. I kept the check. I Xeroxed it and I framed it. And then he told me, and we got to stop talking about me because I want people to know about you. And then I started doing jokes in clubs, and that's how it started.
Well, maybe I should be the host of the Paul Mercurio show. I mean, well, you know.
You're way better at this.
Look at this. I happen to be conducting a better interview with you than you were conducting with me. Paul, you know, it is what it is.
By the way, anybody listening who lives in LA or drives around LA, listen to Max and Marcellus, or Max and Ramona right now, because Marcellus is on paternity leave. A great show on 710.
Thank you,
really smart,
it.
Really entertaining. You're light and funny, but you know your stuff. So how did it pick you? Was boxing pick you or sports broadcasting pick you?
BSing picked me.
Yeah.
I could,
you do have a gift for
you. And
you're Jewish,
and,
right?
Right.
That's a Jew in you.
Yeah,
Jewish,
I speak
like
Yiddish. I speak Yiddish, as a matter of fact.
Do you really?
Yeah, Avada, yeah. But the point is that opining and like thinking about stuff and coming up with the way media works in terms of the opining kind of business is that, because I'm completely without credentials. I mean, you know what? I don't know. I'm just a guy. Oh,
that is true.
You know, that's just, so, but the way it works is the most interesting takes are the counterintuitive ones. So,
for example,
well, something happens and everyone says, well, that's very bad what that person did. And if you can think of it from a point of view, say, well, wait a minute, if you contextualize it, actually, they were morally up, you know, it was a morally upright position to take.
Right.
That can be a counterintuitive take.
And then that creates a better conversation with your listeners, because now you've created some tension, whatever you want to call
well,
it, a little.
It's just it is more interesting to think about or to listen to than the kind of knee-jerk reaction that everyone else is having. Mm. And if you really think about, listen, if you take any topic and you really think about it, and there's a consensus around the topic, whatever percentage of the time, 75, 90%, but some majority of the time, the consensus will be correct. There's a reason there's a consensus.
Right.
But some kind of minority percentage, people haven't thought it through rationally enough.
Right.
Now, you should consider very carefully, wait a minute, there's a reason, there's a consensus. But if you continue to think about it, you say, no, you know what? Everyone's lost their mind on this one. And so those kind of takes are interesting, I think. And you can't be afraid to say them.
Well, that was what I was thinking, is have you kind of alienated listeners at times? And do you get talked to by your bosses at the station, the radio station or ESPN, about like, hey, that's going a little too far? Like,
it depends what kind of show you're doing. And it depends if it's television or radio. Because on television, there's much less time to get into the explanation of how you arrived at that conclusion.
Right.
Those takes are not as kind of TV. TV is synthesis.
Yeah.
You take a lot of disparate kind of stuff, you put it together, you synthesize it, and you spit out the soundbite.
Right.
Radio is the opposite. Radio is unpacking. You take this subject and you take it on, you dissect it, and you put every piece under a microscope, right?
Yeah.
So radio, that is really what I'm talking about, because you brought up Max and Marcellus especially. where you can get into stuff more and say and get into your to your counterintuitive conclusions and then kind of what led up, what the thought process that led up to it.
Do you get frustrated with sports in terms of this? At times I feel like, you know, this is holier than thou, don't look behind the curtain, don't question, you know, and I understand you work for organizations that, you know, make their living by being in business with the sports networks, but I do think, look, I think sports is the most influential part of our culture, frankly. Like, I have a son and you have kids. My son lives on ESPN, and I think girls do too. And there's a lot of crazy things going on in sports on a regular basis. And, you know, you try to use satire. I think you're really good at that. That's another why I'm a big fan, is like, you're smart, but you'll also keep it light and you'll use smart satire to make commentary. Do you ever get frustrated that, you know, the leagues are so you know, defensive, if you will, at times, or protective of their brand?
They're making billions of dollars.
To the point where it's you're sitting on your couch going, this guy's full of shit. There's no way. You know what I mean?
Well, I'll say this. Now, here's like maybe a counterintuitive conclusion. I sense sometimes that, look, it's great to challenge the status quo. Mm. It's important to challenge the status quo because not everyone benefits from it and because it's not perfect. Mm. But at times, the you know, an institution like the NFL or ESPN, right, will take shots that they deserve and sometimes shots that they don't. Mm. And so, for example, now it's gotten to the point where I feel as though the criticism is, like, for example, Roger Goodell in the NFL. There's nothing he can do at this point, because partly that comes from being in such a position of power. Mm. But... And are these benign organizations? Is the NFL benign? The NFL is a corporate entity.
Yeah,
you know, it's in the business of making money. That's its raison. You know, if a shark takes a bite out of a seal, it's not a moral question. That's what a shark does,
it's
right?
Raison d'etre,
right? Is to generate profits. Yeah. So, and that's why we have, you know, we have hopefully safeguards in place from limiting corporations and stuff.
So we
get all that. But I do feel that, and it comes from a good place, the questioning of authority and the mistrust of power.
Yeah, but the problem is sometimes no one wants you to question. And look, it's in politics too. It's what brought Nixon down, right? I mean, nobody in power, some people in power don't want you to ever question the people in power.
And the whole point of, as Dwight MacDonald would have said, the mid-century critic, the you know, a cat can look at a king, that it doesn't, it's that's fine, you know, it doesn't matter who you are, people can look at you and analyze you and assess and give their opinion,
right?
And that's important in, you know, it's in a free press and everything. But and I think as the underlying sensibility is a good one. Which is especially on the left, you notice it in terms of politics, which is there's power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So when we see something that is strong, our instinct is to feel that it is in some way corrupt. Mm-hmm. But the corollary to that, where people go too far, including on the left, is this sense that if something is strong, it is therefore bad. Mm-hmm. But in fact, a very kind of American sensibility, which I like, is to be strong and good and righteous, right? That can happen too. So an institution like ESPN oftentimes takes criticism, I feel, as someone who's worked inside
ESPN.
I'm talking about
yeah,
like it, or at the NFL, for example.
I have a problem with ESPN. I just think it's the NFL, NBA, whatever sports.
The leagues,
the leagues, you know.
They take criticism that is warranted at times, and I feel sometimes is out of proportion.
Yeah, that's fair. I agree. I think you're right about Roger Goodell. Like, I think he's sticking to his guns on this, and I think the court. I mean, what a lot of people don't understand from a legal point of view, the court's really only supposed to look at.
We're talking about Brady now.
Yeah, they're really only supposed to look at the process, and if there was anything, if there's a violation of the process, they can't. They're not legally allowed to get into the details of this.
I think there are two separate issues there. One is, did the NFL overstep? What are they allowed to do, et cetera?
Right.
I agree with everyone that they probably, you know, like, I understand that they probably overstepped. They're probably not allowed to do that. But to me, that obfuscates the bigger issue, which is he got caught cheating.
Yeah.
And Marcellus has a great theory on why he didn't admit it. Because Jerry Rice, like, I'd stick him on my, the greatest wideout who ever lived. admits, I cheated. I had Stickum on my gloves.
Yeah.
No one cares. Joe Montana came out and said, look, you got caught. We all cheated. You got caught. You got to take it and move on. But Tom Brady was not in a position where he could because it was 2 weeks before the Super Bowl. So he didn't want to disqualify himself.
Yeah.
So you got, if you're in his position, you
got to go that route.
Yeah. A dilemma is not a tough choice. A dilemma, as I repeat time to time to remind people, is a choice between two bad options. So he had two bad options.
Yeah.
Admit the truth and take your punishment and let down your teammates and your fans. Or lie and try and get away with it. So he chose, in my view, the second one.
Yeah.
And then after you look everyone in the eye for 2 weeks and say, I didn't do it, it's tough to turn around and go,
all right,
I did it.
Right.
Is it a big deal? It's not a big deal. Why don't they let him play with the balls as deflated as they want? Who cares?
Yeah, well, it's always the cover-up. It's always the cover-up, right?
Right.
Do you, were you surprised that Adam Silver came down as hard as he did with the LA Clippers owner and you know, banned him? I was pleasantly surprised in the sense that, like, you know, again, they tend to protect their own a little bit, and I thought it was a great, great move and sent a great message. I don't know. Were you at all surprised?
As an attorney, I'm sure you appreciate, a former attorney.
Yeah, yeah.
Are you still that thing.
Because when you come to New York, if you get arrested, friendly, you call
my wife's an attorney, and she still has to listen to those tapes every 2 years to get past the bar near.
Yeah.
In the legalistic sense. About Deflategate, you're right. And what was the last topic we were just on?
Adam Silver.
And Adam Silver, in fact, probably shouldn't have, in a strictly legalistic sense, probably didn't rise to the level of kicking him out because his privacy was invaded.
Yes.
You know, even when you see this stuff going on in Adam and Eve and the hypocrites in various organizations who are being outed, I feel that media outlets who are releasing some of that information, I think it's not ethical.
Yeah.
You know, like, I understand they're hypocrites, but this really information, if it's shame on you for kind of report, right? Yeah. So in a strictly legalistic sense, I get it about Deflategate. I get it about people who would be like, Adam Silver shouldn't have done that. But in a larger sense, I think a guy got caught cheating, you suspend him. Come on, dude. You know, and I think also with Adam Silver, it was a great excuse to get a bad owner out of the league, to get a bad guy removed.
Who was doing a lot of bad things before that.
And it's just the league, and Adam Silver, the way he came out, because I think the anticipation was he would side with the owner.
Yeah.
Was so uplifting feeling.
Yeah, it was very definitive. It was no.
Because of the racial component specifically, because it is a sport that has largely been represented by African American players, that this was a deep insult to African Americans specifically, even though it violated his privacy, but still the content was insulting, and that the message Adam Silver sent was, we don't look at you as labor, we look at you as partners. And we are not going to allow someone to insult so many of our partners like this.
Yeah.
And that was almost a watershed moment for major league, so to speak, professional sports franchises in this country.
That's a really good observation. I hadn't thought about it that way. Yeah, I was really surprised at that. And he just gives off a good vibe as a commissioner. Just as we wrap up, you're a big boxing guy and know so much about it. How do you feel about the state of boxing? How do you feel about MMA and sort of the erosion, if you will, of boxing interest a little bit? Do you see it bouncing back?
Boxing simply become more worldwide. So it's never been especially centralized, but it's more decentralized than ever. And so
explain that a little bit.
Well, the world's gotten flatter with media advance, et cetera. And so now you have fighters from all over the world frequently fighting in other places of the world in major fights. That combined with the fact that boxing has no centralized authority. So if I were to say, or if you were to say, hey, you know what they should do in baseball? There are a million baseball leagues. When you say they, you mean MLB. You know what they should do in football? Lots of football leagues. You're talking about Goodell.
Right.
You know what they should do in basketball? You mean Adam Silver. That's the they.
Yeah.
You know what they should do in boxing? Who? They're just a bunch of independent factions.
Is that's always going to been the problem? Or is it a problem? You think it's fine?
No, I
mean, well, all these belts, people can't keep track of what's what.
There's a sociological theory called the tragedy of the commons that applies to boxing. It applies to energy policy in the United States,
too. Slow down. I'm a comedian. I'm not that smart, but go ahead.
An attorney and a Wall Street guy. So the tragedy of the commons, picture these kind of common farming grounds, right?
Yeah.
That 100 families share. Mm-hmm. And it's sustainable. Everyone takes their fair share, and this will go on in a kind of ongoing utopia.
Right.
The problem is this. I know, as one of 100 members of this commons, that if I take 2 times my share, I've increased my lot by 100%. And I've only hurt my friend and neighbor Paul by 1%. I've only taken 1 over 100 extra. Hmm. So the problem is, you know that too. Everyone knows that too.
So
everyone grabs, and the commons, which should be an ongoing utopia, collapse, right? What this is like energy policy in the United States. Markets, what it points out to me is markets are very good at allocating resources in the short term. Mm. But over longer horizons, it's good to have some kind of central
governing
intelligence that can make plans for the future, that can put things in place that maybe tip markets in directions that are that we want.
It's sort of doing it for your own good kind of thing, almost in a way you raise your child. Like, I know this is going to hurt a little bit now, but in the long run, you're going to try.
So Kennesaw Mountain Landis, who was a racist and kept things segregated in baseball, is a bad guy in a lot of ways, but was put in power as commissioner after the 1919 Black Sox scandal, where Arnold Rothstein fixed the World Series. Right. Starting 1920, new sheriff in town. I think he came in 20, but anyway, that was like the modern era. Mm. And I'm sure that owners went to Mountain Landis at certain points and said, hey, you know, Jack Daniels or whoever it is wants to put an ad on the right field wall and give us $5,000, whatever it was back then. And, you know, things like this must have come up.
Yeah.
And the commissioner must have thought, okay, yes, that's good for you in the short run, but in the long run, it'll alienate middle American mothers, right?
Yeah.
So you have to turn down sometimes, even though the marketplace is going in a certain direction, you need to put things in place that tip it in another direction. If you left an unfettered marketplace, a laissez-faire marketplace, oil, oil, oil. But we recognize that there is a greenhouse effect, et cetera. And so with climate change, we'd like to put tax incentives, for example, in place to encourage alternative energy, renewable energy, cleaner energy sources.
Right.
So boxing is very much the laissez-faire marketplace. And that would benefit greatly from some kind of league or tour that was perceived as more legitimate than the others.
Why can't...
And by the way, there's one underfoot now. Al Haymon has his PBC.
Mm-hmm.
And that could turn out to be a version of that. Time will tell.
But is it because the promoters are too greedy and too independent to want to come together under a commissioner? Because essentially the promoters would essentially almost be like... team owners within a league, right?
Well,
you've got a commissioner. So is it just too many people at the table?
First of all, it's the culture. It's the way it's always been done.
Yeah.
Secondly, I don't think of government as the answer in terms of installing some kind of a paid commissioner that oversees all of boxing. I do see it more analogous to like Times Square or Las Vegas, they're geographical locations, but they were. Soulful in a way, like boxing, because there are all these colorful characters, right? But people didn't feel, corporations didn't feel comfortable investing big money until government, local or federal, came in and cleaned up the corruption to the point where now corporations felt comfortable investing real dollars.
Right.
And boxing may be similar to that. Now it's starting that corporations are starting to invest, or there's more investment money.
Mm-hmm. And it, just as we wrap up here, what MMA seems to be a little bit more organized, for lack of a better term. And do you see that? I don't want to say supplanting, but like, you know, it's definitely casting a shadow over boxing, and seems to be the thing that people are talking much more about. Do you think it swings, the pendulum swings back the other way?
Can they
coexist?
Yeah, I think it swung the other way toward boxing already. I think what you're describing
really
was more, in fact, the case 3 or 4 years ago. than it is today.
And why do you think it is? People kind of just got turned off by MMA? Too violent?
No, there's a lot there. I mean, first of all, when you say MMA, you really mean UFC.
Yeah.
So that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Dana White, who was a lifelong boxing fan and a friend of mine, was a huge boxing fan and saw all the ways that he felt boxing, like, and so he creates, essentially, he talks to the Fertitta brothers, you know, they buy Zuffa and they buy the UFC, and instead of running away from regulation, they run toward it, and they created Band-Aid or Frigidaire, or that, you know, the name brand that gains recognition as more legitimate than anything else and synonymous with what it represents. So you don't say MMA, you really say UFC.
Yeah, yeah.
In boxing, you say boxing.
Right.
You don't simply say ESPN boxer or this boxer. You say
so then why boxing. Is a pendulum swung toward boxing, do you think? Because there's nothing jumps out at me boxing-wise other than, you know, Pacquiao. I was at the Pacquiao Hatton fight in Vegas and did some pieces actually for HBO there, but you know, this Pacquiao, this last fight with Mayweather just turned a lot of people off. But other than that, nothing jumps out at me. Now, Ronda Rousey is the name that jumps out at me with UFC, right?
Sure.
So, I mean, like, do they need a... Does the boxing need a Muhammad Ali or, Joe Frazier or Sonny Liston or whatever now?
Boxing is... I do this metaphor from time to time of the street corner, where you come to a street corner, there's a guy... A couple guys playing stickball in one corner, hitting a tennis ball back and forth, and another throwing a football around on the third, and there's a fist fight on the fourth. Where's the crowd? Around the fist fight.
Right.
Now redo the because boxing is more compelling for the reason it's a literal representation, it's not a metaphor for the imposition of will. So why is it when you redo the thought experiment, and now it's Tiger Woods putting a golf ball, and Barry Bonds is hitting against Roger Clemens, and there's just two guys you don't know having a fight. Still, there's some people watching the fight. That's how awesome fighting is. But but now it's a different distribution of the crowd.
Right.
Because we are human beings. We try to fit the world into narratives. We construct narratives to describe what we see. Even science, which is not art, we're talking science, is just constructing models that best predict the future, that best describe reality.
Do you think if there's a star in a sport, it helps us sort of get our head around
in
it,
order,
it fits a model?
Well, almost. In order to be invested in any story, you need interesting characters.
Yeah.
Period. You either care about the characters,
good movies,
you're emotionally,
good literature, yeah.
You're emotionally invested or you're not.
Right.
And so because of these leagues, or tours, MMA is really UFC,
right.
NFL, NBA, getting the stories of the participants out there, you're invested.
Right, because if it were just a bunch of games back and forth, it'd be like, okay, another game. Another game. Yeah.
If you didn't know that was LeBron James and that was Kevin Durant, you wouldn't care.
Right.
If that's Tom
but
Brady.
But it's also a culture of celebrity and people just love stars, too. There's that aspect.
But I think they love stars for the same reason that Shakespeare didn't write about his neighbors. He wrote about kings and queens. Because if you elevate it somehow in people's minds, you deal with the same human condition.
Foibles, yeah.
But now at least you've created a sense in the audience that they should invest in this person, that there's a reason that you should be interested in this, that there's some kind of sympathy. So you need the hero, you need the obstacle. The greater the obstacle, the more interesting, the more compelling the drama, the more you care about the hero.
Sure. That's why Ali Foreman was so great, because you had sort of, Foreman came off as sort of the villain, and Ali and... You know, how I don't know how conscious that narrative was in terms of actually being made up, or it just kind of fell into place, but that makes a lot of sense. So in boxing, you think you have a couple of those characters, then you bring it to another place.
That's why we do Face Off on HBO.
Yeah.
That's why Triple G, this amazing middleweight, knocking everyone out.
Yeah.
He was selling 4,000 tickets a couple years ago. Same guy, same fighter. Now he's selling out Madison Square Garden.
Wow.
Because his people realized we're going to put him on TV 4 times a year on HBO and other, and he's going to keep knocking everyone out, and we're going to put him on Face Off, and we're going to let people know who he is.
Yeah.
Become invested in this character.
Yeah.
Floyd Mayweather didn't used to make the money he makes now.
Right.
Whether you root for him or against him,
right.
You have an investment in him.
Absolutely. Makes sense. Hey, thank you for doing this. Max Kellerman, Sports Nation, every day on ESPN. 710 ESPN in Los Angeles with Max and Marsalis, and so great to talk to you.
Thank
so
you, bro.
Smart, and
appreciate it.
If you get in any legal trouble, give me a call. I'll help
done
you out.
Done.
All right, that was Max Kellerman. Good guy, really, really interesting, smart as a whip, and very opinionated, and really appreciate him being on. And thanks for checking out the podcast. Tell your friends about it, and we'll see you next week.
A Westwood One podcast production.